On this week's 51%, we hear from an author about domestic violence.
The deviousness of abusers certainly stays with me.
Learn about a proposal to provide female service members with proper fitting body armor.
Women are forced to wear equipment designed by and for men.
And Dr. Jerry Burns returns with an essay. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I used to be so afraid of you, and anything you said I would do. I wanted to fight, but afraid that I would lose.
Andrea Harrington is a district attorney in Massachusetts, and she launched the Berkshire County Domestic and Sexual Violence Task Force in April of 2019. The task force unveiled its first initiative in the fall, a community read of Rachel Louise Snyder's No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Snyder, a reporter whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and on This American Life, appeared in Berkshire County recently to talk about the book. She spoke with 51%'s Josh Landes about what compelled her to focus on domestic violence.
I had always done, as a journalist, stories of social justice and human rights. I did stories on women imprisoned for love crimes in Kabul and women gang raped in Cambodia and women forcibly sterilized in Tibet. So I was always sort of interested in those kinds of very gritty human rights stories. And I'd been living abroad for a number of years. When I moved back to America in 2009, I met the sister of a friend of mine, and her name was Suzanne DeBuse. We were standing on his driveway, in fact, and, you know, I asked what she did, and she said she worked at a local domestic violence agency in town, and I said, oh, sure, I've come across that in my reporting over the years. And she told me that she had helped develop a program to predict domestic violence homicide before it happens by using 20 risk indicators to try to predict it and thus prevent it, and this just blew my mind, that you could in some way quantify what seemed to me a sort of amorphous problem of social justice. And so I started researching, and I learned just how much all of us are buying into a set of myths and beliefs around domestic violence that are simply not true. And so I started researching and just haven't stopped.
So the subtitle of the book is What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. I want to get into that. What are some of these things about domestic violence that are not commonly known that allow that to persist as a crisis in our society?
Oh, gosh, there's so many things. I mean, the first is the question that's always asked, right? Why doesn't she just leave? And the fact is, asking that question, I think, shows a deep misunderstanding of what leaving actually looks like. Victims do leave. They leave all the time. And it's almost always when they're in the process of leaving that they get killed. But the other thing is that leaving is not like a suitcase packed at the door. Leaving is a series of really careful, kind of behind-the-scenes background maneuvers that in some cases take years. I mean, what's happening is that victims are trying to negotiate for their safety, and that takes a long, long time. And for some of them, they never make it. In my book, I talk about a woman named Michelle who was doing all kinds of things. She went to the police and filed a restraining order. She had the house put in her name only. Her father owned it, and they were renting it from her father, so she secretly had it put in her name so she could get her husband out at some point. She was in school taking nursing classes so she could someday get a job as a nurse and support her kids. So she's doing all the things that we're telling her to do. We just don't know that this is actually what leaving looks like.
I'm interested, what do you think people who read the book are going to walk away with as far as the skills to identify this persistent issue and to actually reach out to people who are trapped in these circumstances?
Well, I guess I'd answer that a couple of different ways. I mean, one, they'll walk away with just sort of like the sort of mathematical equation of domestic violence in terms of, like, they'll know, for example, that strangulation is different than a punch. When you're trying to quantify dangerousness, they'll know that, you know, guns escalate a situation 8 or 9-fold for someone who's in a violent relationship. So they'll learn kind of fundamentals like that. But also, I think one of the most important elements for me in writing this was to write about how domestic violence intersects so many of the social issues we are facing today. So you may not be standing at the receiving end of a punch, but domestic violence intersects with gender equality with homelessness. In fact, it's the leading cause of homelessness for women in this country. It intersects with mass shootings. It intersects with mass incarceration. It intersects with human trafficking and sexual assault. And kids in foster care are often there because they've lost one or both parents. So there are just so many different ways in which we need to all sort of pay attention to domestic violence and have it on our radar much more than we have.
Were there experiences researching the book that have really stayed with you well after its publication and its rapturous reception?
I love that. It's rapturous reception. Well, the rapturous reception certainly stays with me. That has surprised no one more than me, I think. But there's lots of things that stay with me. I mean, the deviousness of abusers certainly stays with me. There's a guy in my book who went and got a rattlesnake and kept it in a cage and would tell his wife, I'm going to put this in bed with you or in the shower with you if you, you know, don't do what I want. That sort of illicit deviousness is chilling. It just chills me. But there's, I think the other thing that stays with me is that I didn't, you know, we hear a lot about victims and the victim's point of view with domestic violence, as we well should. But what we don't hear very often is from the abuser's point of view or the batterer's point of view. And I really tried to spend a lot of time with people who were abusive, found guilty of various acts of domestic violence, to try to get a sense of who they are. And some of those guys really stay with me. In this case, they were all men. And what you find is that they're often just as stuck as our perception of victims is. They don't necessarily have alternatives for their behavior. They haven't learned alternatives. They haven't learned that they're the product of social and cultural, you know, formation that is just bigger than themselves. And those things really just stay with me.
As far as those intersections between other pressing social concerns, I'm interested when it comes to an overall takeaway on the gendered nature of politics in America. You know, do you see a lack of awareness of domestic violence, you know, applying itself to our legal structure that prevents people from seeking justice?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I could spend the next hour and a half talking to you about that. I mean, you asked about politics, you also asked about the legal system, and I think to me, those are the patriarchy of them and the gendered framing of them is sort of the same, but they're different in how they play out in someone's life. So, you know, just a few months ago, we had the local congressman from Mississippi who clocked his wife, and then the two of them put out a joint statement saying, you know, please respect our privacy while we deal with this family matter. And the fact is, clocking someone is not a family matter. It's a crime. It's an assault, right? If you did that to a stranger on the street, you would be arrested. So that sort of dialogue helps no one, right? It certainly doesn't help their family, but it doesn't give victims the message that we prioritize their freedom in any way over that of the batterer. The other thing is the legal system, and the fact is our legal system, much of which comes from ancient Rome or, you know, the Middle Ages in England, was written by men, and you still have that framing. So I'll give you just one example. Our self-defense laws are written assuming that somebody is of equal strength, equal intent, has equal access to weapons, and that's simply not the case in domestic violence and domestic violence homicide. And you know, some countries, Canada and Australia being among them, have rewritten their self-defense laws to take this sort of biological and gender imbalance into account when they charge someone and when they go through trial. But we have not done that in the United States.
As you've gone out and spoken to communities about your book, what has that been like? What are you hearing from people who really resonated with what they found in your book?
You know, that's a tough question. I think it reaches people differently. I mean, I hear from lots and lots of victims, as you might imagine. I've had moments speaking where someone in the audience will stand up and say, I can't go home right now. What should I do? And those are really chilling moments for me. I don't always know the local lay of the land when it comes to resources. But I think also I sort of view my role right now as kind of being a messenger. You know, a lot of times people in the West Coast don't know what they're doing in the East Coast and vice versa. And I feel like, you know, I'm traveling all over the country right now. And so I'm able to just kind of like bridge some of those gaps and talk about some of the more innovative things that I'm seeing, especially when it comes to small adjustments that make huge changes. And so that's incredibly gratifying.
That was Rachel Louise Snyder speaking with 51%'s Josh Landes. Snyder's latest book is No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. The 2019 book is due out in paperback in June. A U.S. senator is co-sponsor of a measure to help equip female service members with proper-fitting body armor. Kirsten Gillibrand, a New York Democrat, says poorly fitting body armor is a leading cause of preventable injury for service members, especially women and men with non-standard body types.
It's critical that women service members have appropriate equipment during training and deployment. Unfortunately, our military's body armor and protective equipment hasn't always been constructed with the health and comfort of women in mind. Women are forced to wear equipment designed by and for men. However, this problem is not limited to women. Non-standard male bodies, such as those of especially tall or short men, face the same issues. This situation is wrong and unfair. Worse, it's putting lives at risk. That's why I'm announcing my sponsorship of the bipartisan Body Armor for Females Modernization Act. This bill would call for faster procurement and deployment of properly fitting body armor for women and some male service members. The bill would also require the Defense Health Agency to track inquiries associated with ill-fitting equipment. It will enable the department to better address the issue and help in the deployment of future PPE. We must provide total support to every service member, regardless of their gender or body type.
Iowa Republican Joni Ernst is the bill's author.
Joni Ernst drafted the bill, and I co-sponsored it. She and I went to Afghanistan together, and this was an issue we heard from the troops on the ground.
Gillibrand says recent reports by the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services have shown that access to female-specific personal protective equipment, or PPE, and smaller-sized PPE was severely limited and only issued to some women who were deploying and not to any women during initial entry training in regular unit environments. There's a whole generation of female rock and roll and punk musicians. Bands like Bikini Kill and Slater Kinney say they were inspired by a little-known punk band from the 1970s, The Slits. Well, the drummer for The Slits lives on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Her name is Paloma McLarty. She's better known as Palmolive. Producer Andrea Bentanzos recently caught up with her to talk about old times and find out what she's up to now.
So in 1973, Paloma fled Spain. She left her parents, her boyfriend, her home. She was 17 years old.
And I was kind of like desperate to find a different way of life, really.
A friend gave Paloma an address of someone in London she didn't know and she'd never heard of. First time ever on a plane, and she just showed up on their doorstep.
So I knocked on their door, and they were shocked to see this girl there. Like, what are we going to do? I had no idea about anything. They gave me a bowl for cereal and milk, and I didn't know that you put the two together. I had no clue, no clue.
España cumple en los momentos actuales.
Back in Malaga, Paloma had grown up under the last reverberations of Francisco Franco's dictatorship.
Culturally, it was very repressive, conservative, Catholic. I remember one time bringing a book home, and there was a discussion about how that book couldn't be in the house because it was forbidden.
There were rules that needed to be followed, but this was the 1960s, and messages of dissent seeped their way through the protest songs of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. And while Paloma appreciated Joan and Bob, she leaned in hard to Spanish singer-songwriters like Paco Ibáñez.
And I just will drink their LPs. I remember like being one Christmas locked in my room just listening. I knew it by heart.
The poetry resonated with her.
So that was my connection with music. Never thought that I would play music in my life. You know, never had the intention, the desire, or that even it was possible.
But then that possibility presented itself in London. It was 1976, and she'd arrived right at the cusp of a new kind of musical movement, where anybody could start a band. So Paloma dove in. She quickly learned English from the squatter she was living with, and found herself a new boyfriend, a musician named Woody Meller. He had a stage name, though, Joe Strummer, the lead singer of The Clash. Joe and Paloma were young and in love, but Paloma got restless pretty fast. She went to Scotland, back to London, thought, maybe I'll be a mime, joined a performance troupe, quit 3 days later because she didn't get along with the leader of the troupe, and then she picked up the drums.
So I started practicing the roles, and I started playing with the drums, and I was fascinated because it was fun. And then I started, like, hitting the tom-tom and just, like, finding, you know, getting the sounds.
This was a time when London was swarming with bands. And of all of them, Paloma was asked to join the Flowers of Romance, a band started by Sid Vicious.
And I was going to play the drums. Suddenly I had a group, you know, but it was, we had no idea what we were doing.
One night after rehearsing, Paloma remembers Sid was trying so hard to flirt with her. But he was obnoxious. He slapped a swastika on his arm. She had come from a fascist country, after all. And she just wasn't into him, so she turned him down.
Next time I find out I'm not in the group, he kicked me out. I was so upset.
So she thought, screw this.
I said, I don't want to deal with a guy like just I have to sleep with him. And so I decided to form a group with only girls, which there weren't any.
She asked friends of friends, girls she thought had no inhibitions. There were four of them, and they called themselves the Slits.
I don't like England and a man, or someone who lets me down.
There was Ari Up on vocals, Viv Albertine on guitar, Tessa Pollitt on bass, and Paloma on drums. They bleached and they teased their hair as high as it would go. Paloma wore a bright red miniskirt, stilettos in the middle of the day.
If we weren't practicing, we were talking about who we wanted to become. So it was all-consuming. We had no jobs. We lived in a squat, so we didn't have to pay for anything. We lived very simply.
They were living and breathing punk.
You know, we would buy fish and chips here and there, or a bar of chocolate or something. You know, that was our food. Like, we hardly ate. We were consumed by the group.
One night, she was christened with a new name. She was at a pub and was introduced to Clash bassist Paul Simonon.
And he had asked me my name, and I said, Paloma, and he said, Paul Molliff, like joking around. And I thought it was very funny. And I said, yeah, my name is Paul Molliff. And then it's kind of stuck.
And so Paul Molliff raged on. She said there was freedom in being angry.
Being able to be angry, not just peace and love, but if you're angry, you're angry. That's okay. And you should be able to express that.
A newspaper wrote them up as a band that made the Sex Pistols look like choir boys. And you could hear why in the first lyric she ever wrote.
I'm going to be your enemy all for the heck of it. If you like this, I'm going to be the opposite.
It was an angry call to the system.
If you like peace and flowers, I'm going to give you knives and chains. It was just ridiculous, but it was just very in your face like that.
The Slits never became a household name like the Sex Pistols or the Ramones, even though they held their own. When they were deciding on a new manager, Palmolive put her foot down, and so they kicked her out. She ended up joining another influential but barely known female band, the Raincoats. When the band was just forming, Palmolive plastered ads in the windows of the Compendium bookstore in London. They were short and to the point.
Female musician wanted a strength, not a style.
This lineup included Ana Da Silva on vocals and guitar, Gina Birch on vocals and bass, violinist Vicky Aspinall, and Palmolive on drums. They recorded an album and even went on tour. But Paloma was beginning to realize that for her, anger was not enough.
It just got tired. I just felt like there was some things in life that I was missing and I wasn't going to find it there. I knew that there was a spiritual world out there and I needed to focus on it.
This started her on a journey that would last several years. She tried out an ashram in India. That didn't work. She tried living in an anthroposophical community. That wasn't right either. So she kept looking. She tried Christianity, but she felt let down by the church. Eventually, she decided to do away with all the conventions of religion and build a relationship to God on her own terms.
So when you encounter either a group, a political group, a punk rock establishment, a church council. I don't care who they are. And they said, this is how it is. You either like it or you leave it. And it's something that goes really, really against your grain, and you know that it's not healthy, then it's time to leave.
Decades later, Paloma's left the music scene entirely. She's now living on Cape Cod. She's married, she has grandchildren, she makes apple preserves, and she started to reflect back on her life up until this point. Paloma has started the first pages of her memoir. She's thinking of calling it Adventures Close to Home. It's an ode to her favorite song, one that she wrote. Punk or no punk, Paloma does things her own way.
How could I not do what I did? You know, like, something in me was just driving me to really find answers. And I am glad that I did, because I am in a different place. I'm glad that I took charge of my own life, that I didn't let a system just mold me, because I don't know who I would be. I'm glad I'm not so much a product of something that someone decided I should be.
In Hyannis, I'm Andrea Betanzos.
And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns ponders Lost and Found.
Louise Seamster, a sociology fellow at the University of Tennessee, shared a vivid phrase on Twitter, something she heard to describe scholarly academic types. She tweeted that they're like floating heads on sticks. Well, that describes me to a T. One afternoon, I was walking to the Humanities Building at SUNY New Paltz. My mind was caught up in the details of my upcoming class presentation, the new story I was working on, or some intriguing hybrid of both. I was all head. There was no awareness of my body or my surroundings, and when I lose track of the world outside my head, I lose track of my things. That was when this floating head lost her car keys. I mean, we all make mistakes. It comes with the human package. No need to pay extra for it. It's a deep part of human nature that's built right in. And I've got a lot of that. But it also so happens that I experienced that and many other facets of human nature that winter day when I lost my car keys. I initially discovered the trouble after I spent time talking with a struggling student after class. It was dark and cold when I walked to my car. As I bounced across the green, I realized that I didn't hear the familiar clink of keys swinging on my backpack like a child's ponytail. Normally, my keys live on my backpack, securely hooked on with a carabiner. But that night, they weren't on my backpack, in the backpack, or even tucked into my pockets. I retraced my steps, hunched over with my phone flashlight like Sherlock Holmes with his magnifying glass. But my keys were nowhere. This floating head didn't want to lose her head, so I called the university police. "Hi there. I'm going to be stuck on campus for the rest of my life because I lost my car keys. Did anyone turn keys in?" No one had. Thankfully, my husband was available to make the journey to bring me the spare key. Because we live an hour and a quarter away, I had a chunk of time to observe closing time rituals in Worcester Hall cafeteria and to ponder human nature. I thought about how making mistakes is part of the human condition, but I also realized that the ability to make choices is also part of human nature. If someone found the keys, they could make the effort to bring them to the university police or to the student union. But they have other choices, too. They could have tossed them away, or they could have walked around the campus parking lots intermittently pressing buttons on the key ring until they found my car and... Well, because this little adventure happened during Hanukkah, I placed my bet on the positive in people. When I called the police the next morning, there were no keys. I stayed positive, doing my best to bank on the good. The police department is pretty far away from anything else on campus, so it might take a few days before someone could get there. But when I called the police at supper time the same evening, I found out that someone already had journeyed to the hinterland of campus to return my keys. That's when I experienced what may also be another part of human nature. Immense gratitude. I felt an unbridled urge to hug the kind soul who made the excursion on behalf of a complete stranger. I jokingly referred to this as my Hanukkah miracle. But in truth, the return of my keys did feel a bit miraculous. You see, I can't copy my spare key and voila, have another. My leased car has a keyless ignition. Replacing the high-tech key would make a huge dent in our budget and would probably also mean an additional penalty at the end of the lease as well. Another part of me also wondered if the fact that someone took the time to return my keys was part Hanukkah miracle for a different reason. I mean, we live in times when too many people are taking actions that are far from caring, and I've been feeling extremely disheartened. I needed this reminder. But on the other hand, do I sound like Tevye yet? Is doing a good deed really miraculous? Might human beings be naturally more inclined to good than evil? Couldn't it be natural for people to want to help strangers? I sincerely want to believe that caring for others, friends, family, and strangers, is one of the driving forces of human nature. Not a miracle, but the way we're intended to behave. It seems to be the case for one nameless man who found my keys on the New Paltz College campus that winter night. To that man, I want to give my sincerest thanks. I don't know who you are. I asked the police, but they couldn't tell me. But your effort gave me buckets of relief and refreshed my faith in the goodness of humanity. To you and to all others who anonymously go about the world offering anonymous kindnesses, I express my deepest gratitude from the top of my floating head all the way down to the bottom.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1595.